top Iranian military commander says Tehran will target the source of any aggression against its military and nuclear sites. China blames what it calls strategic misjudgments by the United States for the problems in relations between the two countries. And celebrations erupting in Chilean cities following the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the presidential runoff. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A top Iranian military commander is warning that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any attack on its military and nuclear sites. Commander of the Khatam al-Anbiya Central Headquarters warned that Iran won't hesitate in its response. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid says Iran will target the source of aggression, the bases, the territory, and the airspace used for any possible attack. The general noted any Israeli threat against Iranian sites will be impossible without the U.S. support. Back in September, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs said that the regime is preparing a strike on Iran. American and other Israeli officials have made similar suggestions over the past months. Iran has confirmed air defense systems fired near its nuclear power plant in the southern city of Bushehr, saying that it was part of military drills in that area. Deputy Governor of Bushehr Province for Security Affairs says the exercises were held at 5 a.m. local time in the southern parts of the province and in the Persian Gulf area. Mohammad Taghi Irani says the drills were held in full coordination with the armed forces. Iran conducted similar exercises over its nuclear facility in the central city of Natanz on November 28th. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has held his weekly presser with the ongoing negotiations between Iran and the P4 plus 1 in Vienna being the focal point of that event.
The image we have from the JCPOA is a contradictory one. Some people say they are optimistic and there's been progress in talks, but at the same time, some Europeans say there is only a few weeks left, and they are giving an ultimatum to Iran, and they are worried about Iran's nuclear advances. They say the JCPOA has turned into an empty shell. Can you give us a clear image about the talks and the future of negotiations in Vienna, please? Thank you.
Well, basically, the two sides have to avoid warning comments. The wars that are alarming do not have depth. I have already clearly announced, and now once again announced, that the Troika has to know that the JCPOA became void for Iran at a time when the U.S. withdrew from the deal and imposed unilateral sanctions against the Iranian nation, and the three European countries moved in line with the U.S. by not taking any action. I urge the other side to focus on negotiations in Vienna. Iran is neither optimistic nor pessimistic. Tehran is optimistic about the principle of negotiations, and the other side has to be optimistic about the principle of talks, too.
Now, Khatibzadeh says that Tehran is realistic about the path it's taken, and that's why it's taking measures to remove U.S. sanctions in the course of the negotiations. The spokesman noted Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have come out with two new draft documents that are the results of intense negotiations in Vienna. He says the documents are the basis of future negotiations, and Khatibzadeh said the draft documents could have been agreed upon much sooner if the other side had followed the same approach it did during the last days of the Vienna talks. A wave of settler violence spread across the occupied West Bank in the early hours of Friday, severely injuring several Palestinians and causing damage to property. That resulted in new calls for the international community to pressure the occupying Israeli regime into stopping extremist settlers from committing acts of violence against Palestinians and their communities. Let's take a closer look.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked a main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. Four Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Despite what Palestinians, Israeli security officials and rights groups have confirmed as a clear rise in settler attacks on Palestinians, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett recently said otherwise, calling settler violence a marginal issue. Now, some believe that's a deliberate attempt to legitimize settler violence against Palestinians.
Last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means, but we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. you might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry has blamed strategic U.S. misjudgments for the problems in bilateral relations. Wang Yi says that China does not fear confrontation with the U.S., but it would welcome cooperation if it was mutually beneficial. He says competition between the U.S. and China should be positive. Beijing and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including trade, technology, Taiwan, Hong Kong, COVID origins, and the South China Sea. The latest flare-up, the U.S. announced it would stage a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics in Beijing. China shrugged that off, but promised a response. A virtual summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in November produced no breakthroughs either. International and independent China strategist Andrew K.P. Leung says Washington's maximum confrontation with Beijing is likely to continue given the deep-seated bias against China inside the U.S.
The reality is that there's so much misunderstanding and this ingrained into the American politics and also in the psyche of the American electorate that China is a threat, China is a demon, that this kind of maximum pressure, maximum confrontation is likely to continue. But hopefully the United States would discover to its cost that all this kind of maximum pressure doesn't work. And there could be areas of cooperation. Of course, the areas could be very, very large and could be expanded. Mutual trust is built. First of all, of course, is on climate change, on the use of green energies, the export of American technologies, for example, on electric cars. After all, the electric car market in China is the biggest in the world. And also using American technology to help China extract its shale gas reserve, which is the largest in the world, but is geologically challenged, much more difficult terrain. And of course, even in the South China Sea, in open waters, without away from the territorial claims, there are areas where both countries can organize joint patrols. And if both the Chinese Navy and the American Navy can jointly patrol open waters away from the territorial disputed areas, they could send a very signal of peace and cooperation to the region.
Sure.
And there are others, one can go on. But I think the first important thing is to build mutual trust.
The people in Chile take to the streets in the capital Santiago to celebrate the victory of leftist candidate Gabriel Boric in the presidential runoff. Streets in other cities also erupted in celebration. Boric garnered 56% of the votes, with almost 99% of the ballots counted. His rival, far-right José Antonio Kast, secured 44%. Several Latin American presidents have congratulated him. He'll take office for a four-year term, starting as of March next year. The new president will be dealing with some of Chile's big challenges, including high inflation, the COVID pandemic, and social unrest. He'll also be in power for the approval of a new constitution that's in the process of drafting. The commentator Tim Anderson says that the victory of leftist Boric in Chile's presidential runoff marks a shift from the country's past, largely defined by Pinochet and his dictatorship.
Gabriel Boric is one of the generation of student leaders from about a decade ago. He's from the far south of Chile, and he's been in parliament for two terms as a member of parliament. And this his election victory now is a very important break from the past, particularly because his opponent was very specifically aligned with the Pinochet past. And as you said in the introduction, he's going to preside over next year the implementation of a new constitution, which is the first time they've managed to break from the constitution set up under the Pinochet dictatorship.
Now, in other news, several American cities witnessing a record number of homicides this year. That according to a study conducted by AFP. According to the study, Philadelphia has the highest record with at least 535 homicides in a population of 1.5 million. The federal capital of Washington has witnessed more than 200 homicides, while smaller cities like Albuquerque, Portland, and Oregon have also set records. The study says a convergence of factors is to blame. The reverberations of COVID and the varied traumas it triggered, as well as a record profusion of guns in the country, are among those reasons. Gun sales set a record in 2020 with nearly 23 million firearms sold. Meantime, top of health officials are urging American people to get their COVID booster shots amid an outbreak of the Omicron variant of the disease.
Well, I think people just need to be prudent. Clearly, when you travel, there is always a risk of increased infection. That just goes with respiratory illnesses. But if people need to travel and want to travel for the obvious family reasons during this holiday season, if you're vaccinated and you're boosted and you take care when you go into congregate settings like airports to make sure you continually wear your mask, you should be okay. But we are going to see breakthrough infections, Chuck. There's no doubt about that.
Now, Fauci is warning that if the current trend of infections continues, hospitals across the U.S. will be overwhelmed with patients again. The Omicron variant has been identified in 43 out of 50 states and is likely to become the dominant strain in the country. The government is scrambling for more vaccinations as over a quarter of the U.S. population has not received a single dose yet. Only 40% of eligible Americans have taken their booster shots. The United States is the world's worst-hit nation by COVID, both in terms of caseload and fatalities. Some 800,000 Americans have already died from the respiratory disease. Now, infections and deaths from the Omicron variant of the COVID are increasing across the world, with the UK reporting 12 related fatalities. British Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab says over 100 people are also hospitalized with Omicron infection. The UK says that the new variant accounts for a majority of its active COVID cases. Other European countries are also witnessing a surge in the number of Omicron infections. Concerns over the spread of the new variant are also growing in the U.S., where health experts have urged people to get their booster shots. Omicron has been detected in nearly 90 countries. The World Health Organization says that Omicron is likely to replace the Delta variant in areas with community transmissions. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Economic divide.
racial and ethnic inequality and racism. These are issues that are widespread in the U.S. But what if these issues came at an economic cost and not just small amounts? What if they ran in the trillions of dollars? Hi, I'm Kavitawi. That appears to be the case in the U.S., which is what we will be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, these are some of the highlights. Racial inequality, racial output, $51 trillion lost in U.S. GDP. The exclusion of minorities, African Americans and Latinos in that mix is something that is highlighted in reports that have come out, one from a Federal Reserve CEO. Also, the roots of inequality, something that the U.S. Is plagued by, and some of the consequences, jobs, education, and pay, things that inequality shows itself in these different sectors. And one of the other highlights of our report and of our program today would be how COVID-19 has exposed inequality in the U.S., its impact on minorities, which has been more than whites, and how blacks and minorities are actually more jobless because of COVID-19.
Economic Divide looked at a study from a source within the U.S., Mary Daly, the San Francisco Federal Reserve president. She has said, "The imperative for equity, for closing some of these gaps, is not only a moral one, but is also an economic one." The study looked at three factors at the base. If black and Hispanic men and women held jobs at the same rates as whites, if they completed college at the same rates as whites, and if they earned the same as whites. From labor alone, they figured the gains would add up to $22.9 trillion over 30 years, from the years 1990 to 2019. The larger $51.2 trillion estimate factors in an increase in capital investments that a more productive labor pool could be expected to trigger.
So we looked at, our thought experiment was, what if we equalized by gender, men and women, by race, different racial groups, and gave people the same opportunities in education, employment, occupational choice, and even how well they're allocated to jobs that demand the skills that they've already acquired. And what we found is all of those things matter. The big ticket items, of course, were getting people the right amount of education and then getting them in positions that are equivalent to their education and having them paid appropriately for the education and skills that they've earned. And those were things that, you know, they increase innovation, they increase productivity, and importantly, and this is the main bottom line, they increase economic output. We estimated that over the last 30 years, it's $30 trillion in lost economic output to our country.
So racial discrimination in the United States, that does not take us by surprise, even though it has reached alarming levels in that country. Yet looking at social media posts, it is still quite revealing what is not being done about it, which in turn is reflected economically in that country. I mean, take this entry, which is actually from the White House itself. It said the racial wealth gap has direct roots in discriminatory federal, state, and local policies. Well, let's take a look at what Joe Biden said, the current U.S. president, on his campaign trail. In this clip, which you're going to see, delivering remarks on his Build Back Better plan, which is on advanced racial equity in America's economy.
Most people wouldn't even think the Fed has anything to do with this. Its existing mandate promotes maximum employment and stable prices. Under my plan, I believe the Fed should add that to that responsibility and aggressively target persistent racial gaps in jobs, wages, and wealth, revise its hiring and employment practices, and achieve greater diversity at all levels of that institution, including diverse nominees for the Board of Governors and the regional banks.
Well, there you have Biden himself talking of the reality, and it's glaringly obvious here how the U.S. is aware of the discrimination that's taking place. That it's not providing a fair representation out there when it comes to all segments of the society. And here is a person citing one of the unfortunate realities out there when it comes to people of color, especially African Americans. about the real aim of this program, how minorities, especially African Americans, are the hidden economy of the U.S. as represented through these successful African Americans.
I'm going to do this in reverse order. So first I'm going to introduce Tristan Wilkerson. He's a general partner of High Street Equity Partners, focusing on investor relations, capital raising, and performance. Tristan is an experienced policy professional, angel investor, and entrepreneur with demonstrated success in both the public and private sectors. He's a former congressional aide. Our next speaker is Ron Busby. Ron is the president and CEO of the U.S. Black Chambers. Ron is a former successful business owner himself. He has been recognized as one of the nation's best CEOs.
Now, it wouldn't be fair if there was not an African-American female representation.
And last but not least, Olivia Bundles is the author of On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, which is the New York Times notable book about her entrepreneurial great-great-grandmother that was the inspiration for Self-Made, a fictional four-part Netflix series starring Octavia Spencer.
Okay, joining us in the studio is Graylin Hagler. He is a pastor and justice advocate. We also have the pleasure of having Marzia Hashmi with us. No need to introduce you, Marzia. Thank you, first of all, for coming.
Thank you
Journalist,
for inviting me.
Activist and media personality. Okay, first let's listen to Graylin Hagler. Graylin, we have this report that is the basis of our program indicating that $51 trillion has been prevented from being contributed to the U.S. GDP and the segments of society in the U.S., minorities, which includes African Americans and also Latinos. Let me get your reaction on that, on why this has happened, and if authorities are going to do anything about it, because they are aware of that this has actually happened.
Well, while they're not reacting to it, it's because there has been a historical and persistent racism that has existed in the United States of America, a discrimination from before emancipation. I mean, folks were held as chattel slaves at one point in this country. And then with the emancipation of the Emancipation Proclamation after the Civil War, folks were so-called set free. But there had been always numbers of things that continued to sabotage the economic advance of the black community, such as the Congress and their mismanagement of the Freeman's Savings Bank, which left 61,000 depositors with losses of nearly $3 million in 1874.
Yeah, well, the list goes on, as he was about to say there. Marzia, this is what's incredible here. We know about the discrimination, and that's what I want to hear from you about in summary form. And then you have the other side where minorities and African Americans are included in that. In a sense, they have been prevented from contributing to the U.S. GDP in terms of the economy, as he just cited some examples. So tell us what you think about that and if you have even personal experiences that you may contribute here.
Right. It is quite a paradox, Kaveh. On the one hand, you have the United States with the greatest economy in the world, and on the other hand, you have this minority group, especially African Americans. I'll look at that side of things, that have been prevented from even contributing to that economy in the way that they could have. And so in the long run, the United States has actually shot itself in the foot from actually preventing some of its citizens from reaching their potential. Yes, of course, I agree with Reverend Hagler and what he says, and of course I have personal experience. I don't think that there's a black American, especially my age, for sure, who has not experienced that. I grew up in a time that black parents taught their kids, you have to understand where you are, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far.
Yeah, and what's spectacular in this whole thing is the fact that you have U.S. authorities who are aware of that, and you have the current U.S. president on his campaign trail, in which he talked about how they're going to set aside a fund for people who have been prevented from actually getting their fair share or shake to contribute to U.S. society. We're going to listen to him, and then I'll come back with a reaction from you.
Sure.
That's what racial equity in our economy looks like. Here's another step we're going to take under my Build Back Better plan to fully include more people into the deal. We're going to strengthen the Federal Reserve's focus on racial economic equity.
All right. On his campaign trail, so I don't know if it's him making that then, to get votes, or if he actually means what he's saying. Do you believe the president and whether he's going to follow through. I mean, how can you change something that's been in the U.S. society for so long in terms of discrimination?
We're talking about systemic racism.
Right.
We're talking about a system that has to be changed, not an individual that can make certain promises. We look at over the years, we have seen many candidates and many presidents even make many promises. I mean, even under the presidency of Obama, as a matter of fact, the situation for Black Americans became worse. So, no, I don't think that there's anything that is going to be done just from a promise.
Very well. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Marzia Hashemi, here with us, journalist, activist, and media personality.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for coming. And we had Pastor and Justice Advocate Graylin Hagler speak to us before that. Now, the following is another experience of a person either of color or a minority and his or her experience with how they have been held back from contributing to the U.S., at least, economic cycle.
The opportunity for good jobs, it wasn't there, you know, and sadly to say, you know, where I lived in New Orleans is what I've experienced. I think it was more who you know at that time to get that job, and you didn't have to have a degree. And it's just so sad to say it because a lot of people, they struggle because of that. You know, there were times where even with school, you know, I couldn't even get my sons in a decent school.
Our infant news section is upon us, and as the end of the year is approaching us, can you believe it? We are not coming short on topics. Well, our first topic is about wealth inequality. A new report has revealed that the richest 1% took 38% of new global wealth since the year 1995, and the bottom half got just 2%. It went on to say that global inequities in wealth and income are, quote, about as great today as they were at the peak of Western imperialism in the early 20th century. There you go. That's how it stands. Next story, inflation. How many more times are we going to talk about this? But it is something that's persisting. Money-hungry corporations, this entry said, are to blame for it. Corporate profiteering is forcing workers and families to make unnecessary sacrifices so that wealthy executives can make themselves richer. And, of course, that means their pay. While the pay for median employees, well, that fell by 8%. So, obviously, you're looking at the inequality that happens there as a result of that. It's called a wage gap. Next up, we go to Sri Lanka. The economy there is not doing well. We reported on this a few months ago, and the problem is still there. As food and energy prices are soaring, Sri Lankans are going without their basic necessities. Now, one reason that is cited is that the Sri Lankan government, its efforts to hold on to foreign exchange reserves, is blamed for creating shortages of basic goods as a result. And our final look at the news from this, or recent news, I should say, global arms sale. A recent report came out, and this is really not surprising, that weapons trade is booming. Profits are hitting record profits overall. $531 billion is what it came at for the year 2020. And the top five companies, they're all from the U.S. And one part of the world that has sold the most weapons to, West Asia, otherwise known to the rest of the world as the Middle East. And, of course, again, that comes in at a record. Well, the end of the year is upon us. And with that, we would really like to hear from you when it comes to, for example, topics that we should cover, like in this section, before the year is actually over. But the contact information is behind me. Make sure you drop us a line so that we can cover a story, especially in your part of the world.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section, which we will drive home how the disparities between whites and other races which amounts to racial discrimination, cost the U.S. economy trillions of dollars. Let's take a look at the disparities between black and white men. We looked at businessmen. Here you have a white businessman, $100, and for the black businessman, they're $5.04. Now, what does this mean? It means for every $100 of white wealth, black families have only $5.04, if you can believe that. Now, the disparity also holds for wealthier black families. The 99th percentile black family is worth a mere, what do we have? $1,574,000, while the 99th percentile white family is worth over $12 million. That's a little less than $11 million, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. Now, unemployment's great gauge of how the disparity shows itself there. People of color, which includes black, Latinos, Asian whites, and then all, when it comes to whites, they have a lower unemployment compared to the rest of them. The green line here, these are the whites. The timeline was February 2020 all the way through to December 2020. Let's try to get some sense out of it. Joining us for a breakdown of this is Darwin Fishman. He's a lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University in California. So Darwin, welcome. When we take a look at this report, there were ranges of $19 trillion all the way through to $51 trillion in terms of how much money to U.S.'s GDP blacks and minorities in general could have added. Well, why is it that these demographics have been held back from their contribution to U.S. society, economically speaking, of course?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Thank you. And yes, racism is real here, and definitely that's one way it manifests itself. You can see that in terms of things like income and salary and employment. And it's true that when you hear the numbers you just rattled off, it sounds horrible, and most people want to make a moral judgment. What we have a more difficult time wrapping our heads around is there's actually a lot of people that actually are not embarrassed by that and don't want to change that. The status quo is also really real, and it is based on that racism.
Well, when we take a look at an example of this, if I can pick one, Darwin, let's take a look at Wall Street, for example. They are accused of discrimination, looking at what they have done, for example, in terms of banking, as I'm seeing over here, options in minority neighborhoods for mortgages, things of that nature. There has been discrimination against African Americans especially, but overall minorities. Why is that happening?
Right. And again, media wants to separate the two, because once you establish, as that data suggests, the numbers you shared, there is the racism, it's not by accident. And so in that sense, trying to change it is not simply identifying the problem. Wall Street, in that sense, becomes even more extreme, because you can also make a really compelling argument on the other side that their success is based on the racism. That's baked into it. And we know that historically, we go back to the history for Africans in this country, slavery was profitable. It's what set the U.S. aside from Europe and made the success that we had.
All right. Let me thank our guest Darwin Fishman, lecturer in sociology at San Diego State University from California, spoke to us. Now, throughout the program, we're going to actually look at some case examples of either blacks, Latinos, or minorities, and the experiences that they have had when it comes to either racial discrimination or them being held back from contributing to the U.S. society.
We know very well that the pathway to generational wealth is owning a home, is having savings, is having life insurance, is having college savings accounts for our children. So we worked very hard to stay very simple and save to get to where we are. Over the years, the promotions, I think, helped as well, both for myself and for my husband, because even now we aren't paid the same as our white counterparts.
When one takes a look at racism, there are instances of it that are either repeated or built upon from the past. And of course, this comes at an economic cost. These are some of the instances that prevent economic contribution from minorities, be it African Americans or Latinos. Take public education. This has actually been underfunded in many African American majority schools, As a result, skill acquisition and upward mobility is prevented. Employment discrimination happens in different forms, which makes it hard to escape things like poverty. And then there is the criminal justice system, higher incarceration rates for minorities, there are also higher guilty verdicts, even higher bail money, and greater chances of monetary sanctions. Employment discrimination among minorities is worth taking a look at, since there are many jobs that are characteristics of this group. Taking a look at this chart, it shows occupations with a high black worker concentration. The lowest is childcare workers, coming in at 17%. Home health aides, nursing assistants, security guards, and bus drivers are the higher ranking ones. But take a note at the average median wage, which falls below the standard wage. Compared to whites, the median wage for all US workers is around $42,000 per year. But 43% of black workers earn less than $30,000 annually. And take a look at the black share of the labor force, 12.9%. And here's something not reported or known in the US. Many black neighborhoods don't have sufficient access to goods and services that are taken for granted in other everyday white majority neighborhoods. One out of every five black households is situated in a food desert, defined by the USDA as a low-income neighborhood with inadequate access to food. In terms of housing, blacks have 53.7% of their income go toward housing, when the average should be 30%. When it comes to healthcare, black Americans are nearly 2.4 times more likely than white Americans to live in a neighborhood with limited healthcare services. And in terms of banking, bank branches have been closing rapidly in recent years. And according to FDIC, nearly half of all black households did not have enough banks in 2017, compared to just 20% of white households. Our final look is on the internet availability to minorities, especially blacks. This is a big one, since its effect is felt on a wide scale of US economic activity. When it comes to broadband, black households are 50% more likely to live in areas with limited broadband service. And many internet service providers impose credit checks or require cash deposits from new customers. This is why black consumers are more likely to participate in e-commerce, since they are a segment that has become mobile first compared to the whites. If you feel we have left anything out, please let us know. We would love to hear from you. From me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next week.
The problem of racial inequality in the U.S., particularly against African Americans and Latinos, is deep-rooted. As our guests have pointed out, some of this goes back to the days of slavery in the case of African Americans. But so what? Does that mean that the status quo in the U.S. should continue? U.S. officials in charge, like the current President Joe Biden and even the Federal Reserve, know that minorities have been held back in the U.S., as shown in the study that we revealed to you, and that they can greatly contribute to U.S.'s economic GDP. But how can that happen when you are looking at a greatly divided U.S., perhaps more than at any other time in U.S. history? That's something to think about. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mikova Tafoyi and the entire team at Economic Dividers, goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'in rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at humanity from the perspective of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. One of the issues that we have when it comes to family is the right of children, and to be specific, when it comes to his right financially. And today we gave it a call, we gave it a name under the title of child support. Now, child support might be a new concept in the secular system, in the so-called advanced world, but in fact, that is not new to us as Muslims. Where Islam has established the right of a child to financial advantages even before these systems think of it, over 1,000 years, that system been established in Islam. Now, with children, because they have special needs and because they cannot work and defend and do things for themselves, so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made it a requirement that we need to take up our children, and we need to make sure that they are fed, clothed, and that they have enough money for their survival. Now, we see this happens a lot when we have divorces, where one of the parents neglects his job to pay for his child, especially when it comes to the man himself. And most of the times, as we see in these secular systems that we live in, one has to resort to going to court, or the woman has to resort to going to court to seek child support for her kids. Where the father says, well, with me no longer, then I don't see myself, liable to pay for you or your child. Now, that's just a wrong mentality. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, says that one must maintain and take care of his kids. Now, having said that, it is a matter of child support is a very sensitive issue. One of the problems that we face, especially in the secular system, that give women so much rights over a man, more than obviously what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has dictated. Now, Allah says when it comes to the child himself, his well-being and his care and his maintenance and finances and everything in between is in fact the duty of the father. So the father has what we call the duty of care for his children. So he must be providing for his child, considering that the child is under his protection. So if the father is fine and, you know, logically he's okay, financially he's okay, then the mother has no business in taking that child from his dad, because he is the one who needs to maintain him. That's the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, if we look at it in depth, well, we do say that child at a certain age stays with his mother, a girl at a certain age stays with her mother, but then they have to go back to the father. He's the one that needs to maintain them. If we break that chain, or the chain of command, of chain of sequence, chains of laws, then the system falls apart. Let us take a break and we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, and we are looking at the rights of a child when it comes to his finances. So we did say that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in a saying that seems to be a bit controversial, that he says, قِلَّةِ الْعِيَالِ أَحَدُ الْيَسَارِ, that if you do find yourself financially not capable to bring children and to have children and maintain them and sustain them, then you should not. That's what the hadith says. It says one of the easy ways to, you know, in life is to have less kids. So if you have 1, 2 kids, 3 kids, maybe more is not in your advantage, not for you, but for the kids themselves. Because we do see in so many countries with parents who have too many kids, they keep bringing them into life without knowing how to maintain them and how to take care of them. And most of the times, these kids end up being in the streets, these kids being orphans, or these kids being homeless, or what have you. And then, because of this, we had systems in place to even prevent people from having children in the first place. So we're going into both extremes here. So we have, in some countries, birth control, where you've been told what you can and cannot have. For example, in some countries, you're only allowed to have 1 child. For example, in China, in some countries, may be allowed to have 2, and so on and so forth. And you see, in certain countries, they might, you know, trying to propagate abortion and make it legal, and so on and so forth. If we went by the Islamic system, we wouldn't have these problems to begin with. So when one has too much kids, obviously he will find himself unable to sustain them. Now, we're not saying that one should not have children, or one should, you know, limit himself to 1 or 2 children. No, have as much as you can, considering the fact that you can maintain them, you can care of them. Because sometimes you say, Allah will provide. Surely Allah will provide. But Allah will provide for those who think, for those who contemplate, not for those who do not think. When we look at some countries and we see so many kids in the streets and kids even being dragged into army and gangs and what have you, because the parents, they had no system in place. They don't know what to do with their kids. If you are financially very well off, if you have a house, you have everything else, and you know you want to have kids, by all means. But unless you have these things in place, then it's going to be a calamity, like Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi said. So the child himself has a responsibility, has a right that need to be maintained by his parents. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu.